Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another podcast of the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. It is good to be back with you. I am Stefan Sasse, a contributor to the Tower of the Hand and essayist there. I have also my own blog for all things nerd at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com. And with me is always, as always,
is Sean T. Collins. I cover Game of Thrones and other television shows for Rolling Stone. I am the creator of All Leather Must Be Boiled, a Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones blog located at boiledleather.com, and I am the co-author of the official annotated to Game of Thrones for subtext.com with Elio Garcia from westeros.org and Anne Grohl, the editor of A Song of Ice and Fire. And speaking of Elio, we are covering, excuse me, today, an excerpt from a book that he had a hand in, along with his partner Linda Antonsen, and of course George R. R. Martin, which is The World of Ice and Fire, the forthcoming world book encyclopedia collection of backstory type thing. And a few weeks ago now, actually, it's been a while, Elio and Linda unveiled on Westeros.org a sample chapter about the Rhoynar.
Yeah, exactly. This sample chapter, it came out on May 14th. And it gives us the story of the immediate conflict between the Rhoynar and the Valyrians that sparked Nymeria's flight from Essos with her 10,000 ships. It is a fairly short excerpt, I'd say. You can read it in about 10 minutes, I guess, and we will link it in the description of the podcast. So what did you think about it? There are several things in there that came a little bit unexpected, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest one for me is water magic, which we'd never heard of before. you know, I think I've probably written about this, if not talked about it within the podcast, but it basically seemed, up until now, that you were dealing with two sort of large, sort of amorphously connected groups of magical phenomena. You had one that's associated with the North and Westeros, and you had one that's associated with Essos, basically. The Northern one involves, let's say, the Wall, skin changing and warging, Greensight, the Others, the Whites, Dire Wolves, stuff of that nature. In this, the Essosi version involves all the stuff that you associate with R'hllor, you know, seeing things in the fires, pyromancy, the sort of breath of life, resurrection stuff, Miri Mazdur, dragons, the glass candles. You know, so basically ice on one hand and fire on the other. Now, however, we discover that along the Rhoynar lived all these sort of water sorcerers who had a completely unrelated set of magical powers to work with, involving water spouts and apparently grayscale and all kinds of other things, one assumes. The turtles are sort of their magical animal of choice, I guess. Which is huge, to me at least, as a fantasy nerd. Huge, huge, huge development for this world.
Yeah, I agree definitely on the fact that it is a huge development. I am not quite sure whether I like it or not. Because for me, the one thing that Song of Ice and Fire always was is a very low fantasy world. And this description with 250,000 people army and 300 dragons and water magicians and stuff like that, it sounds more of Dungeons and Dragons than of A Song of Ice and Fire. Mm-hmm.
That's true. I don't think it bothers me, though. I mean, with the World of Ice and Fire in general, you do have to deal probably with a little bit, maybe. I'm saying probably. I don't mean probably. I mean perhaps. With exaggeration on the part of the author, because the whole book is written from the perspective of maesters who don't, you know, who are unreliable narrators. This is not Martin saying this is exactly how it is. This is Martin saying this character within this world thinks this is how it is. He's probably right, mostly. He's not necessarily right in every particular. He may have his own points of view that are political or personal. He may be exaggerating. He may get something wrong. You know, that said, I've also seen people talk about this as though it were Elio and Linda wrote the excerpt, and Elio has told me it wasn't. This was completely written by Martin. So that said, I don't get the sense that all the water stuff is made up. I mean, maybe some of the scale of this is exaggerated somewhat, but that seems like a big invention if there was no such thing as this magic. So, I mean, I think we do have to assume that there was. And I kind of like it, you know. I mean, I think it's interesting that it's been extirpated from the world as far as anyone can tell. Grayscale is still a concern. And when you get to the Bridge of... Is it called the Bridge of Sorrows?
I think, yes.
Something weird happened there when Tyrion passed through. You'll recall from Dance, where they kept sailing, but somehow it wound up in some kind of warp zone and returned to the same place twice, which makes no logical sense. It was obviously magic, and it was fucking terrifying. Like, I remember reading that and being like, whoa, that was really creepy, because there was no explanation for it. You'd never seen anything like that before. You kind of have to reach back to the House of the Undying and the weird... disconnect between, you know, the way the magic in the House of the Undying played with the physical layout and scale of the building, and you know, so it was a very uncanny effect, and you know, maybe that's the last remnant of, you know, this once very powerful strain of magic in the world. I don't know, but what I'm saying is what I like about it. Is that you can have this whole thing that shaped the whole society and that acted in the world in as concrete a way as, like, the Children of the Forest once did or the dragons once did, but now is gone. Because that's what happens when you fuck with old Valyria. you know, it sends a message. It tells you, it communicates something about how the world worked in addition to adding, you know, this sort of new... you know, mana class or whatever the fuck, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we have more magic in the backstory, and as long as it remains there, I don't think I have that much of a problem with it. I would be more bothered, I guess, if it now turns out that the orphans of the river, or how they are called, are water magicians or stuff like that, you know?
Uh-huh.
What lesser fantasy writers do.
Right, right. Because, I mean, Martin, I think, has been... I remember listening once to an interview with Martin and the doofus who wrote Aragon, you know, who basically treated magic like math and was very excited to share this, and Martin's just like, sure, kid. You know, I like the idea of sort of having a vague sense of how magic works in your world, but I don't like magical systems. That just sort of gets... That, to me, is like... That's well and good if you're writing the official handbook of the Marvel Universe or whatever, but it's not... I think that kind of detracts some from using magic in a compelling way in fiction. So, yeah, I don't necessarily then want to see, like, now a third party enters and they have this power and, like, you have to figure out who's more powerful. I just think it's a wrinkle in the world that I didn't see coming at all, and got a lot out of. And you know, and I guess in theory, it's one that could still influence the present day narrative without having it be, you know, now having all a bunch of like water sorcerers emerge, because Grayscale is still a going concern, very much so. It seems like it'll be bigger than ever in the last two books between Selyse and John Connington. And just sort of the hints that it's going to matter in the end. So, you know, is that still tied to that, this sort of more or less extinct form of magic, or is it its own separate thing? I suppose you could also wonder, like, is this connected to the Storm God and the Drowned God, you know, that we've that have involved themselves in theory with Storm's End and the Stormlands on one hand, and the Ironborn and the Iron Islands on the other hand. I don't know.
I guess we have to wait for the whole thing to see. I mean, I'm really interested in reading The World of Ice and Fire.
Yeah.
It is not like some other people that are saying, oh, I won't touch this. It is a travesty. but I'm a bit concerned about these things. Maybe they turn out all right. I'm reserving judgment for when I have the final thing in my hands. But there are things in there that, don't sit that well with me. And I guess we will come back to that when we talk about Rogues the next time around.
Okay.
The more interesting thing to me is not the water magicians and all that kind of stuff, but the history that goes along with it, because obviously I'm a bit of a history nerd, and so this information that we get about old Valyria and about the Rhoynar as a civilization, to me was really interesting, because Valyria has often been compared to the Roman Empire, and I guess never with such reason like now that we have this story, because Valyria has these colonies, and these colonies are assisting each other, and they can call upon the mother country, and it is a republic, and all of that seems very much like Romans with dragons, which I'm totally cool with. I like the setting and the brutality that the Valyrians have displayed in all these past stories that we have heard, especially in A Dance with Dragons, and the casual let the slave die approach that they have fits very much within that picture. And that is one thing that Martin is really good at, and I think this excerpt proves that point once again. He can develop a culture, a civilization, and a political background in a very short amount of time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This text is not very long, but it creates a believable Rhoynar culture and civilization. And you can see where their strengths lie with these warrior culture and the water magicians, and where their weaknesses are, and that they are these fiercely independent people who are proud to take on 300 dragons by themselves, and all that stuff. And it fits with what we know about the Dornish, you know, the calling to spears, and now let's take on all the Seven Kingdoms because a Lannister happens to lead them, and all that stuff. It fits nicely together and creates a very rich fabric.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I suppose what you have here is if old Valyria is the Roman Empire, the Rhoynish civilization is Carthage?
I guess, yeah.
Right? You know, they fucking salt the earth.
The Greek and Etruscan colonies in general.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I guess that's a discussion for which we should get Stephen Attewell.
Yes, he'd know better than I would.
He's the expert on that stuff.
Right.
And he had some thoughts on his blog, but he didn't delve too much into it. I expect that we will invite him back when the whole book is out.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, I guess the way I would process this is that, you know, as I alluded to earlier, there's a level, you know, I think the thing that impressed me the most in looking at this as a history lesson is the scale and severity of the Valyrian reprisal against the Rhoynish for rising up against them. You know, this like basically an entire air force of dragons descending on them, you know,
yeah.
Fucking hanging the dude from the walls while they slaughtered everyone in his city. That's a glimpse of Valyria. You know, I guess what I would say is that a big difference between Valyria and ancient Rome in terms of the role Valyria plays in the imagination of the characters is that you don't hear as much about Valyria as this like pinnacle of civilization. I mean, you do in certain ways. They built the roads, and they have these great swords and things like that. But mostly it seems like frightening.
Yes.
You know, you mostly hear about them in terms of they had these dragons that killed tons of people. No one could mess with them. They conquered the world, pretty much. They had all these slaves. And it got to the point where, like, the gods themselves destroyed them.
Yeah.
You know, obviously I can't go back to a medieval mindset and find out what those people thought about Rome. Maybe that probably is something that one could do. But certainly today, when we think of Rome, we think of Rome as, like, this sort of lost golden age of civilization that, you know, descended into decadence and then fell to barbarism. That's sort of the generalized pop culture picture of Rome. And
yeah.
Valyria, I think, is just, you know, Martin's not painting Valyria that way. Nor is, you know, and I guess to name a fantasy equivalent, Valyria is not exactly Numenor either, you know. Numenor eventually descended into decadence and barbarism itself, but in Tolkien's story. But you know, there was a golden age of Numenor, and there's like a whole group of people who were still loyal to that and founded a new regime. You know, in Middle Earth proper, once Numenor sank and so on and so forth. That's not really an equivalent. It's a good old days. Strain of thinking regarding Valyria, you know?
Yeah, we have mentioned this earlier, that it is peculiar that the Targaryens never brought much of a Valyrian culture with them.
Yeah, right.
They assimilated totally into Westerosi culture.
Right.
And I am curious whether or not we will get an explanation for this.
Yeah.
But it may be just this bad reputation that they that Valyria has, this might makes right approach that they are using. Perhaps the Targaryens wanted to distance themselves a bit from that, a bit from this. I don't know.
Yeah, and then you know when.
I mean, from Dornish perspective, this excerpt that we have now read. I mean, they are keeping the memory of these events. In their vivid memory, there is this song about Nymeria that even Arya has heard, and her 10,000 ships, and I guess it will be a very long epic. So this whole story that the Maester draws here is maybe just a prosaic version of the song of Nymeria's 10,000 ships. What do we know? So the Dornish obviously have kept that in memory. And when the Targaryens came and conquered the Seven Kingdoms, I can quite understand why they didn't want to give up. So that makes this dogged Dornish resistance makes a lot more sense if you have this information about Dornish and Rhoynish and Valyrian history. Man, I'm messing with these words.
Well, yeah, it's still, yeah, right. The history is still alive within that culture. You know, and perhaps, I mean, you know, I think another question is, like, with the stuff that goes into the world of Ice and Fire, are we to deduce anything from that? You know, the same with the big excerpts that have, you know, that are now running in a couple of these anthologies now. Is Martin writing this stuff? This stuff specifically, because it's relevant to the present day narrative. Like, are we learning all this about the Rhoynar so that we understand the Dornish better for when the Dornish start doing stuff, more stuff, if they start doing more stuff in the next two books, you know?
Maybe, but I don't. I have two feelings about this. For one, he could have put more usable information in there if he wanted to specifically explain stuff. And on the second, it seems to me that he has written much of this a long time ago. So he definitely didn't write it just for the Winds of Winter.
Mm.
The date of publication may be tied to it. I don't know. But as far as I know, he has written some of this stuff way back.
Right. A final thing that I wanted to bring up, and then, you know, if you had any other points, I'd love to hear them, is that, like all of the material that takes place in Essos. I think one of the things that you should take away from this excerpt is that the Game of Thrones is played all over the world, over and over and over again. And it all has the same paramount importance to the people involved that the one we're watching unfold in Westeros and in Meereen has to the characters we're involved in. You know, right now there's the added element of the Others, which is a genuine existential threat, which is the complicating factor in the story. But, like, you know, here Martin, in fairly short order, lists the First Turtle War, the War of Three Princes, the Second Turtle War, the Fisherman's War, the Salt War, the Third Turtle War, the War on Dagger Lake, the Spice War, and many more, too numerous to recount here. All these wars were of paramount importance to the people who fought and died in them, you know. But now they're just a list in some Maester's encyclopedia entry. And yeah. I think that's something that's very, very important to keep in mind when reading the main action of the story. You know, in terms of how human beings see themselves and their struggles and conflicts, and how universal that is, and
Martin is definitely a very adept scholar at amateur historian history is, I guess, the word. I mean, he is not a learned historian, not a historian by trade, and sometimes that shows, especially when he. When his love for a good narrative gets the better of him. But he definitely understands some of the deeper mechanics about remembering history and what role history has in the minds of the people. We have the same phenomenon in our own history. I mean, the more something lies back, the more like are we to just sum it up as a list. You know, you just think of the history of America. It is discovered in 1492, and then there are settlers coming at around, I don't know, 1600 or so, founding Jamestown and all that stuff, and then there's the Mayflower, and then we just jump forward 100 or 150 years to the independence and stuff. But if we go in our contemporary history, in the Cold War, we have nearly every year filled with really important things, you know. But go 400 years back and we're jumping a century or something.
Mm-hmm.
So we have definitely the same thing going on here. And he is very keen in pointing that out. And in this unreliable narrator thing is also something that he is very good at, and which he hasn't shown. Too many people have taken historic sources at face value and just thought because Caesar Augustus has erected a statue of himself that is inscribed with his big deeds, that these deeds are true. And Martin does not fall for that, and that's something I like.
Yeah, and I think given the degree to which in Feast Dance the unreliability of history, right down to like how many years have passed in this society, is becomes such a theme, I think it's really interesting that like it's after that book, it's in the interregnum between that giant mega book and the next one that all this history starts coming out. I'm really curious to see if it does. You know, it obviously resonates with that theme. I think it'll be really interesting, you know, when all is said and done, to look at this stuff in the context of the Finnish series and see how it informs our understanding, not just of the facts of the made-up history, but of what Martin's trying to say about history in general.
Yeah.
That's a nice note to end on, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you again, everybody, for listening. We should be back again, hopefully pretty shortly, with a chapter on the recently released Rogue Prince, with a chapter and episode. Look how confused I am.
Yeah.
All right. But yeah, thanks as always, Stefan, for talking to me. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, for me too. And thanks to you all people for listening to us and our rambling about all these nerdy issues. So hopefully you will be back with us soon. And then we'll discuss even more sample chapters and excerpts and stuff like that. So I wonder if we are back to our usual analysis at one point, but Martin is bombarding us with this stuff at the moment.
I feel this I think is the third Turtle War episode, basically, and then there'll be the Fisherman's War episode, and so on and so on. Just keeps coming.
Yeah, we should just start calling them that.
All right, everybody. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah, bye.
Bye-bye.